This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with The Week magazine of May 8th. Blame game erupts over Trump assassination attempt. A California man accused of trying to storm the White House correspondents' dinner with an arsenal of guns and knives was charged with attempting to assassinate President Trump as investigators dug through writings and social media posts that showed his increasing fury at the administration. Cole Tomas Allen, a 31-year-old high school tutor from Torrance, checked into the Washington Hilton ahead of the black tie dinner there. As waiters cleared salad plates in the ballroom, packed with more than 2,000 journalists and Beltway insiders, Allen sprinted past a security checkpoint carrying a shotgun and a 38 caliber handgun. One federal agent opened fire, and another in a bulletproof vest was shot in the chest but was unharmed. Allen tripped and was jumped on by agents who stripped him of his weapons. In the ballroom, attendees crouched under dinner tables as the President and First Lady Melania Trump were rushed out along with Vice President J.D. Vance and cabinet members. "It scared all of us," said CNN anchor Wolf Blitzer. "We had no idea what was going on." Before the attempted attack, Allen wrote a note detailing his plan to target Trump administration officials prioritized from highest ranking to lowest. He referenced abuse in ICE detention camps, the U.S. bombing of a girls' school in Iran, and the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. "I am no longer willing to permit a pedophile, rapist, and traitor to coat my hands with his crimes," he wrote, in apparent reference to Trump. Neighbors and acquaintances described Allen, a leader of his college's Christian fellowship, as quiet and respectful. But on social media, he raged against Trump. "Everyone already knows Trump is an effing awful person in multiple dimensions, and no one has done shit," read one April 2025 post on the Blue Sky platform. Trump called for unity at a press conference following the incident, but the tone soon shifted as White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt blamed the assassination attempt on the deranged lies of Democrats who falsely label and slander the president as a fascist and threat to democracy. Trump, who has survived two previous assassination attempts, called this one a marker of his success. "The most impactful people," he said, "are the ones they go after." "This was a security fiasco," said Hugh Doherty in the Daily Beast. How was Allen able to stroll into the Hilton with a shotgun in his luggage, check into a room, and roam freely? "After I checked in, I was never asked for ID, and I walked into the dinner with a ticket that could easily have been a photocopy. Actually, the Secret Service did its job," said Garrett Graff in his Substack newsletter. "Securing a hotel with some 1,100 rooms isn't their responsibility, nor is it to prevent any incident at a high-profile event. Their task is to set up a security perimeter and keep the president safe, which is exactly what they did." Allen presents a puzzle, said Odette Youssef in NPR.org. A well-liked young man with a master's degree in computer science, he was incensed by Trump administration policies. But his online history displays none of the extremist or conspiratorial views that typically drive would-be political assassins. His writings express pretty moderate left-wing views, said extremism researcher Jared Holt. It's left him and other experts unclear as to what tipped Allen over the edge. "There's no mystery here," said Jeffrey Blahar in National Review. "Allen hung out on lefty-dominated Blue Sky and seems to have been radicalized into committing violence by the panic and apocalypticism common in such spaces. In his manifesto, he accused Trump of being a pedophile, a wild, reckless lie that is commonly bandied about by Trump haters, and one that is intended to inflame. Now we see where that line of rhetoric can lead." The right's attempt to pin this attack on Democrats is cynical and bogus, said Peter Hamby and Puck. But progressives can't shy away from the fact that a rising miasma of conspiratorial thinking, dangerous fact-denying, and dehumanizing language has taken hold on the American left. Before a trans rights supporter shot dead conservative activist Charlie Kirk and Luigi Mangione allegedly murdered a healthcare CEO in a fit of anti-corporate rage, it was easier for liberals to claim the nut jobs and wackos were mostly on the other side. That's no longer the case. Trump is the primary cause of our culture of political violence, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. At the start of his political project in 2016, he urged his supporters to punch people they disliked. Since then, Trump has unleashed a mob on the U.S. Capitol, referred to anti-ICE protesters murdered by his regime as domestic terrorists, called his political opponents enemies of the people, and cheered the deaths of his critics. Now he and his supporters are shocked that the violent world he willed into being is coming for him. We're watching the best democracy on earth destroyed by madness, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. In a nation where firearms outnumber people, we've reached the stage where attempted assassination sites are getting recycled. President Ronald Reagan was shot and wounded outside the same Hilton in 1981. Last month, we collectively shrugged when a disturbed father killed 8 children in Shreveport, Louisiana, and a mall in Baton Rouge erupted in a Wild West shootout. We'll no doubt soon move on from this latest grim spectacle in an unserious America where appalling forms of violence feel increasingly like business as usual. King Charles's mission to charm Trump. President Trump welcomed King Charles III on a rare 4-day state visit, the first by a British monarch in 2 decades, as the UK attempted to mend its special relationship with the United States. Trump, who said his Scottish-born mother loved the royal family, greeted the king at the White House with full military honors, a parade, and a troop review, and called him a fantastic man. The king spoke to a joint session of Congress, saying the Anglo-American bond was irreplaceable and unbreakable. But along with praise and gentle jokes about the American Revolution, what Charles Dickens might have called a tale of two Georges, he said, he included veiled criticism of Trump. The king cited the Magna Carta as the foundation of the principle that executive power is subject to checks and balances, including an independent judiciary. Praising NATO for keeping North Americans and Europeans safe, the king noted that the only time the alliance had ever invoked its joint defense clause was to assist the U.S. after the 9/11 attacks, and he called for unyielding resolve to defend Ukraine. Trump called it a fantastic speech, and while the king was speaking, he posted a photo of himself with Charles captioned "Two Kings" in a dig at the No Kings protest movement. The president also gave a state dinner for King Charles, Queen Camilla, and over 100 guests, mostly Republicans or billionaires. Trump, who has strongly criticized Britain's reluctance to join the Iran war, later said the king had privately agreed with him that preventing Iran from going nuclear was imperative. Buckingham Palace clarified that Charles had merely reiterated Britain's well-known position on the prevention of nuclear proliferation. Though Trump has hit the UK with tariffs and threats, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com, he remains starstruck by the royals. Perhaps that's why King Charles could say things that would get lesser figures lambasted on Truth Social. In his address to Congress, he implicitly frowned on America's current political direction and defended pillars of Western democracy. That a monarch supposedly endowed with divine right should lecture our elected legislature on the rights and responsibilities of democratic societies was one of the visit's many political and historical ironies. It was the closest thing in a long time to a kumbaya moment on Capitol Hill, said Ben Jacobs in Slate. Lawmakers laughed along with the king as he assured them he was not planning some cunning rearguard action to retake the wayward colonies. His several standing ovations were not partisan, even if his checks and balances talk received more enthusiasm from Democrats and his claim that Christianity was a firm anchor of our common traditions more from Republicans. His real mission was to repair that special relationship, said Janan Ganesh in the Financial Times. In recent weeks, Trump has dissed Prime Minister Keir Starmer as not Winston Churchill, threatened to drop U.S. support of British sovereignty over the Falkland Islands in favor of Argentina, and made Europe less safe by threatening to pull out of NATO. But here is a clue. If the relationship hinges so much on who is in the U.S. administration, on whether their mother was Scottish, it is not special. The British ambassador to the U.S., Christian Turner, has admitted as much, saying in a recently leaked chat that the only special relationship the U.S. has nowadays is with Israel, not the U.K. If bilateral ties have weakened, said Gerard Baker in the Wall Street Journal, blame Britain's decline from global superpower to minor league straggler. Trump may have been characteristically cruel in ridiculing the Royal Navy's toy ships in March, but he was right that it's not much of a force at just 25 warships. Britain's share of global economic output has shrunk to a piddling 3%, and there is no doubting the cultural and political melees plaguing the English. Still, let's hope the king reminded the president that allies, even ones in decline, are useful to have. What we should hope for is a return to a more grown-up era of foreign policy, said Rosa Price in Bloomberg, defined by meaningful dialogue. For now, the glow of royalty may have soothed Trump's fury at what he perceives as Britain's failure to stand by an old ally. But there are only so many times Britain can point the sovereign in the direction of the president and hope. Deadlock with Iran. Who will blink first? The war with Iran has hit a toxic stalemate, said Jana Brancolini in the Daily Beast. American officials poured cold water on a proposal from Tehran to end the two-month conflict under which the U.S. would end its naval blockade of Iranian ports and Iran would reopen the Strait of Hormuz, a crucial oil shipping route whose closure is choking the global economy. The regime's nuclear program, meanwhile, would be discussed at a later date. A U.S. official said the nuclear punt was a non-starter because it would deny Trump a victory, and in a 4 a.m. social media post, accompanied by an image of Trump as a gun-toting action hero and the caption, "No more Mr. Nice Guy," the president made his feelings clear on Tehran's offer. "They better get smart soon," he wrote, saying the regime's only hope is to go non-nuclear. For now, Trump is set on an extended blockade of Iran, said Alexander Ward in the Wall Street Journal. He's decided his other options, walking away or resuming bombing, carry more risk than targeting the regime's coffers in a high-risk bid to compel a nuclear capitulation Tehran has long refused. Time is on America's side, said Mark Dubowitz and Miad Maliki in the New York Post. While U.S. motorists grumble about gas topping $4.60 a gallon, the remnants of Iran's regime are battling triple-digit inflation, mass unemployment, a currency in freefall, and a U.S. blockade that has them bleeding cash. Worse, said Amit Sigal in the Free Press, Iran is now drowning in its own oil. Within a few weeks, Iran will run out of storage for the crude it pumps out of the ground, leaving the regime no option but to halt production and see extraction systems clog up, a death sentence for its oil industry. Don't underestimate Iran's pain threshold, said Ben Gaiman in Axios. The country has alternate storage facilities, including a fleet of floating crude carriers, and continues to sneak tankers past the U.S. Navy. And experts say the regime has other revenue sources, including oil exported over land, to keep its troops paid and its position in Iran secure. Iran believes it can hold out for at least another 2 or 3 months, said Ali Vaiz in The New Yorker, and that the American timeline is more like 2 to 3 weeks. With Trump's approval rating hitting a record low of 34% in a new Reuters poll, the regime thinks cost of living pressures will force him to back down and save Republicans from a wipeout in the midterms. Trump also doesn't want the war to dominate his mid-May visit with Chinese President Xi Jinping, let alone for jet fuel shortages to ruin this summer's World Cup, which the U.S. is co-hosting with Mexico and Canada. Trump might still be able to reach a deal with Iran, said Katrin Benhold in the New York Times, but it won't be as good as the Obama-era pact he ripped up in 2018. That deal barred Iran from enriching uranium above 3.67% purity. Its current stockpile is at 60%, and with further processing could be used to build 100 nuclear bombs. And Tehran now has better cards to play than during the negotiations for the 2015 deal, including control of the Strait of Hormuz. For future talks to have any chance, Trump will have to abandon his I win, you lose approach to diplomacy, said Trudy Rubin in the Philadelphia Inquirer. As gas prices climb higher, perhaps he'll accept a compromise that lets both Iran and the U.S. save face. But based on everything we've learned about our president, this hope requires a suspension of disbelief. New Bern, North Carolina, indictment do-over. The Justice Department secured a new indictment against former FBI Director James Comey, signaling a renewed effort to pursue charges against one of President Trump's frequent targets. A federal grand jury in North Carolina charged Comey with threatening to kill the president last May by posting a photo on Instagram of seashells arranged to read 8647, an apparent nod to the slang term 86 for getting rid of something, and 47, referencing Trump as the 47th president. Comey later deleted the post amid a backlash from Trump allies, saying he didn't realize some folks associate those numbers with violence. It's the second case brought by the DOJ against Comey, who became a critic of Trump after the president fired him from the FBI in 2017. In September, Comey was indicted for allegedly obstructing a congressional investigation, but that case was thrown out by a judge who found the U.S. attorney prosecuting it had been improperly appointed. Legal experts said the seashell case was likely to be tossed before reaching a jury. This might be the worst case the DOJ has filed in my lifetime, a former department official told CNN. Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche has taken a flurry of actions against Trump foes since taking over from Pam Bondi, who was fired as Attorney General last month. Under Blanche, the Justice Department has secured indictments against the Southern Poverty Law Center, as well as a former senior aide to infectious diseases expert Dr. Anthony Fauci. It also stormed 20-plus businesses in Minneapolis along with the FBI as a part of a federal fraud investigation that Trump has championed. It suggests Blanche is publicly auditioning for Trump to give him the permanent AG role. The test will be whether these cases succeed in court. Los Angeles, bad joke. Federal regulators ordered an early review of ABC's broadcast licenses just a day before President Trump called for the firing of Jimmy Kimmel, the network's late-night star. The FCC said its review was connected to a lingering investigation into the diversity and inclusion policies of Disney, ABC's parent company. But the agency announced the move just as Trump renewed attacks on Kimmel, a longtime foe, for joking in his monologue last week that First Lady Melania Trump had a glow like an expectant widow. The joke aired days before a gunman attempted to assassinate Trump at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Kimmel said the gag was not, by any stretch of the definition, a call to assassination. The FCC has never before ordered a sweeping review of a major TV network's licenses, which allow the company to broadcast in local markets. This is about as extreme an action as I've ever seen the FCC take, said Gigi Sohn, executive director of the American Association of Public Broadband. Baton Rouge, voting rights. The Supreme Court threw out a congressional map drawn to protect black voting rights in Louisiana, weakening a key provision of the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act in a decision that carries major ramifications for the November midterms. The court ruled 6-3 along ideological lines that Louisiana's two-year-old voting map constituted racial gerrymandering. The justices did not strike down Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, but they effectively reset its interpretation, saying challengers would need to prove that states intentionally drew districts to disenfranchise minorities. Today's decision renders Section 2 all but a dead letter, wrote liberal Justice Elena Kagan in a dissent, portions of which she read aloud from the bench. The ruling is expected to trigger a redistricting scramble in several southern states, led by Florida, which quickly approved a new congressional map that could add up to 4 GOP House seats. Washington, D.C., unprotected. The Supreme Court's conservative majority appeared inclined to side with the Trump administration in a case that could expose 1.3 million immigrants to deportation. The White House tried in February to end temporary protected status, a program offering humanitarian protections to people from war-torn or disaster-hit countries for Haitians and Syrians. Two class action lawsuits covering over 350,000 Haitians and 6,000 Syrians argue that the move was unlawful. The government can remove countries from TPS, which protects about 1.3 million immigrants from 17 nations. But lawyers for the Syrian and Haitian TPS holders claim the administration didn't act in good faith and failed to consult relevant federal agencies 60 days before curtailing the program. President Trump has repeatedly targeted Haitians, spreading unfounded allegations about them eating pets in Ohio during his 2024 campaign, and saying Haitian immigrants hail from a filthy, dirty, disgusting country. Manta, Ecuador, U.S. bombs drug boats. The U.S. military killed three more people in a strike on an alleged drug boat, the Pentagon said. Evidence that attacks on such boats did not end with the U.S. incursion into Venezuela in January. Instead, strikes in the Pacific and Caribbean have escalated with the deployment of more warplanes and drones. The Trump administration calls the more than 185 people killed combatants, but most legal experts say they are civilians whose killing violates international law. An Ecuadorian crew whose boat was obliterated in a drone strike said U.S. forces have been arresting survivors and handing them to El Salvador. They handcuffed us, put hoods over our heads, Johnny Sebastian Palacios, who'd said he was a fisherman, told The Guardian. We were terrified they were going to kill us. Kyiv, anger at Israel. Ukraine is accusing Israel of buying grain stolen by Russia from farms on occupied Ukrainian territory. This is not and cannot be legitimate business, President Volodymyr Zelensky said on social media. European officials said one ship in Russia's shadow fleet of unmarked vessels used to evade sanctions, had unloaded Ukrainian wheat at Israel's Haifa port in mid-April, and another arrived bearing thousands of tons of plundered barley and wheat. The EU said it would enforce sanctions against Israelis involved, while in the U.S., Senator Ruben Gallego, Democrat of Arizona, chastised Israel, saying it should not be in the business of cashing in on Russian war crimes. Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar said Zelensky had lobbed his allegations before providing Israel with any evidence. Ukraine has not submitted a request, he said. It has submitted tweets. Dubai, United Arab Emirates, quitting OPEC. In a bombshell announcement, the United Arab Emirates said it was leaving OPEC to sell its oil without the cartel's limits. The UAE is OPEC's third largest oil producer and has clashed with the group's de facto leader, Saudi Arabia, over production quotas. Since the Iran war broke out, these tensions have deepened as the UAE complained its Arab neighbors didn't do enough to protect it against Iranian strikes. The UAE is a key U.S. ally, and its sovereign wealth fund has invested hundreds of millions in the private equity firm of President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. By weakening OPEC with its departure, the UAE has given a boost to Trump, who for years has accused the cartel of inflating oil prices and ripping off the rest of the world. People, Theron's legacy of trauma. Charlize Theron was shaped by brutality, said Lulu Garcia Navarro in the New York Times Magazine. Growing up in South Africa in the 1980s, you couldn't avoid violence and turmoil, says the actress, 50. Her hometown saw violent uprisings against apartheid and vicious state repression. I saw things I shouldn't have seen at a very young age. I saw a man burn inside a car on the side of the road. Violence permeated her own home. Her father was a full-blown drunk and a scary one. He didn't hit me, but there was a lot of verbal abuse, a lot of threatening language that just became normal. Her mother spent years thinking about ways to extricate herself and Charlize. Then, when Theron was 15, her father tore into the driveway after a drinking session, and I just knew something bad was going to happen. Theron and her mom tried to barricade the front door, but he began shooting through it, making it very clear he was going to kill us. When he gained entry, Theron's mother pulled her own gun and shot him dead. The next morning, she sent me to school. She was just like, "We're going to move on." Not necessarily the healthiest thing, but it worked for us. Now a campaigner against domestic violence, Theron says these things should be talked about because it makes other people not feel alone. I'm not haunted by this stuff anymore. Abortion bans are failing in every way. Since the Supreme Court overturned Roe, abortion rates have increased nationwide, said Greer Donnelly and Yvonne Lindgren in Slate. That was the conclusion of the Guttmacher Institute's latest report on abortions in the U.S. in 2025, which is consistent with the findings of two other organizations that track abortions. Abortion rates have gone up even in all but two of the red states that banned the procedure because of the mailing of abortion medications and abortion travel. Every month, up to 15,000 packages of abortion pills are shipped into these states, enabling women to safely end pregnancies at home. One type of abortion, however, has declined, abortions for medical reasons. In theory, red states make legal exceptions for abortions to save the life of the mother, but the laws are so restrictive that doctors are afraid that they'll be prosecuted for treating pregnant women who are having severe life-threatening complications. As a result, horror stories of women dying, nearly dying, or birthing dying children have been reported on a regular basis. The evidence is in. Abortion bans do not reduce abortions, and they do not protect maternal health. Abortion bans are unworkable and serve no rational purpose. Trump, now a pro-drug president? We've entered a new era in Republican drug policy, said Nathaniel Weichsel and Mallory Wilson in The Hill. President Trump signed an executive order to loosen research restrictions on psychedelic drugs to treat mental health conditions such as PTSD and depression. Then, just days later, the Justice Department reclassified medical marijuana from a Schedule I drug, a category that includes heroin, to Schedule III, alongside medications such as Tylenol with codeine. Individually, the orders did not do much to change the status quo. Recreational marijuana and psychedelics such as LSD and peyote remain illegal under federal law. But together, the moves show how the drug-friendly Make America Healthy Again movement is reshaping the GOP. Clearly, this is no longer the party that once told Americans to just say no. Our children will suffer for it, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The weed reclassification sends a message of government approval for a drug that is harming young brains. A study released of 11,000 adolescents found that pot use impairs brain development, leading to worse verbal recall, inhibition control, and working memory. Is the goal of Trump's order to reduce America's collective IQ? But rescheduling is not full legalization, said Adriana E. Ramirez in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. It's an attempt at fixing the mismatch between law and reality. All but two states now allow some form of cannabis use, yet researchers who want to study its harmful effects and potential medicinal uses have faced a maze of restrictions. The Trump administration did the right thing in fixing that absurdity. Was that Trump's motivation, said Laura Esposito in The Daily Beast, or is he trying to win back MAGA bros? Men under 45 swung for Trump in 2024, but now disapprove of him by a 19-point margin. Polls show the cohort heavily favors weed legalization, so his pro-drug shift may be little more than a bid to get them on side for the midterms. No one should be fooled into thinking Trump is calling off the disastrous war on drugs, said Anthony L. Fisher in MS.now. In fact, he's intensifying it. Trump has killed at least 185 people with his extra-legal military strikes on suspected drug smuggling boats in the Caribbean, seized Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro for the crime of narco-terrorism, and deported thousands of people for nothing more than a long-past drug offense. If you think this president truly wants a more enlightened drug policy, you're high on your own supply. SCOTUS, the rise of the shadow docket. By issuing crucial rulings without written opinions, the Supreme Court has betrayed the Constitution, said Charles P. Pierce in Esquire. That's the takeaway from leaked court memos recently published by the New York Times that reveal the origins of the shadow docket, an abridged process in which the court issues rapid rulings without oral arguments or written opinions. The leaked memos were written by the justices just prior to the court's first use of the shadow docket, its 5-4 ruling in 2016 blocking President Obama's policy to limit power plant emissions. Since its birth, the shadow docket has become the conservative majority's favorite workaround to support policies it favors and kill those it doesn't. Chief Justice John Roberts, who once promised to neutrally call balls and strikes, has been revealed as a complete hack who repeatedly used the shadow docket to curtail the authority of Presidents Obama and Biden while giving free rein to President Trump. In shadow docket rulings, the court has given Trump more than 20 big wins on immigration and firings, thus expanding presidential authority. Chief Justice Balls and Strikes seems a bit confused. Particular shadow docket decisions can be legitimately criticized, said Michael W. McConnell in The Washington Post, but wholesale condemnation of the process is not warranted. These rapid rulings are an inevitable result of the controversial use of executive power started by Obama and escalated by Biden and Trump. More executive orders mean more lawsuits, which can take years to wend through the courts. Shadow docket rulings are temporary interventions giving courts more time to deliberate, not an underhanded scheme to benefit one president. "That's just not true," said Harry Litman in his Substack newsletter. The leaked memos revealed the justices' shadow docket deliberations were merely hastily sketched thoughts from partisan actors. The Supreme Court's authority rests on the persuasiveness of its reasoning, but secretive rulings by decree have undermined the ideal of a modest, impartial, and deliberative court. "It's a court in crisis," said Eli Mistal in The Nation. Justices have been casting some not-so-collegial shade on their colleagues, with Ketanji Brown Jackson, Sonia Sotomayor, and Clarence Thomas recently admitting that the court is deeply divided. The justices should stop pretending they are neutral arbiters above the political fray. They are political creatures down in the muck with the rest of us. Health and Science: an mRNA vaccine for pancreatic cancer. "There is finally hope for those with pancreatic cancer," reports NBCNews.com. One of the deadliest cancers, it kills over 87% of patients within 5 years, with most dying so quickly they can't be enrolled in clinical trials. But now there's a personalized mRNA vaccine that shows striking early promise. In a small trial at New York's Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, 16 patients with early-stage pancreatic cancer received a vaccine custom-built from genetic material taken from their own tumors. The goal was not to shrink existing growths, which were removed surgically, but to train the immune system to hunt down and destroy any lingering cancer cells before they could cause a recurrence. Half the patients responded, producing specialized killer T cells that target tumor cells. 6 years later, 7 of those 8 are still alive. The researchers say the vaccine appears to generate helper T cells that sustain the immune response over time. "This is one of the hardest cancers to generate any immune response for, let alone such a potent one," says trial leader Vinod Balachandran. "The results remain preliminary, and the treatment is only suitable for patients with operable tumors. But it's the most promising breakthrough yet." "The most important finding here," said William Fried, pastor of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, "is that the people who mount a response to the vaccine live longer." Television: everyone is doing great. The indie comedy about two former teen stars, created by former teen stars James Lafferty and Stephen Coletti, is rolling out its second season 5 years after its first, Monday, May 11th, Netflix. Independent Lens, Natchez. This mesmerizing documentary settles down in Natchez, Mississippi, to watch how the rosy stories tour visitors hear about at the town's antebellum mansions clash with the tales others tell about Natchez's role in the slave trade. Monday, May 11th at 10 p.m. PBS. Check local listings. Streaming tips: new music profiles. Noah Kahan, Out of Body. Indie singer-songwriter Kahan hit the stratosphere with his 2022 album Stick Season. This candid documentary catches him selling out stadiums, contending with a level of fame he didn't expect, and returning to his Vermont roots. Netflix. Epic: Elvis Presley in Concert. Elvis's Las Vegas years have long been joked about, but this concert doc, assembled by director Baz Luhrmann from Lost Footage, rewrites the history. Backed by a killer band, the king holds court, dazzling night after night, $20 on demand. The Moment: Charlie XCX mocks music documentary cliches with this parody about prepping a major tour to stretch out her brat summer moment. Celebs including Kylie Jenner pop in as themselves, while others including Alexander Skarsgård play character roles. $8 on demand. BTS, The Return. The band that made K-pop a global phenomenon recently reunited after a four-year hiatus during which all seven members completed mandatory military service. This Korean language film captures the septet rediscovering joint purpose as they work on Ararang, an album that topped U.S. charts in April. Netflix. Lainey Wilson, Keepin' Country Cool. In this warts-and-all portrait, the country sensation recounts her upbringing in Louisiana, the hard work that led to her breakout, and the life she's put on hold to entertain. Netflix. The Rise of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. In the 1980s, the Chili Peppers were just shirtless kids bringing some funk to LA's punk scene. The band's heart was guitarist Hillel Slovak, who died of an overdose just as the group was getting big. Anthony Kiedis, Flea, and the others return to the beginning in this touching tribute. Netflix. CEO pay increased at 38 of the 51 biggest utilities in the U.S. last year to an average of $12.3 million a year, according to industry watchdog Energy and Policy Institute. Utility CEO compensation has risen 47% since 2017. The average American chief executive is now 61 years old, up from about 51 two decades ago, according to a research paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research. The trend is most pronounced among smaller, privately held firms. The average age of CEOs at S&P 500 companies was 58.5 in 2023. Bloomberg. Stocks. Why investors aren't fazed by the Iran war. Many people are surprised by the stock market's recent resilience, said Nir Kesar in Bloomberg. I'm not one of them. The war with Iran has fractured energy markets, causing oil prices to spike and sending recession jitters across the global economy. Yet investors have carried on unfazed, pushing both the S&P 500 and NASDAQ indexes above their record highs recently. The market appears to be riding a tech-led boom that war is unlikely to reach. Stocks were down nearly 8% in March, overlapping with the start of the war, but about 60% of that decline was attributable to just 20 stocks, most of them correlated with artificial intelligence. In other words, Iran had little to do with it. And while the war has since continued, the market has recovered strongly. What has led the turnabout? AI-correlated stocks like Broadcom and Micron. It's tempting to assume that global stock markets should precisely mirror real-world crises, said Zachary Carabel in the Washington Post. But that's wrong. Markets react to uncertainty. By now, the reality of more than 10 million barrels of oil a day removed from global supply because of the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz has been digested, and investors have reasoned that the war will not substantially weaken thousands of listed companies, or at least not enough to derail their longer-term growth. In other words, the markets are already looking beyond the conflict. It's hard to argue that investors are wrong for doing so, said Theo Francis in the Wall Street Journal. So far, corporate earnings show that companies are far healthier than some analysts feared. Year-over-year growth in earnings per share is expected to exceed 13% for the sixth quarter running, and sales are set for their fastest rise since 2022. Still, the stock market isn't the economy, said economist Mark Zandi in the Philadelphia Inquirer. U.S. consumer sentiment is at a record low as Americans struggle with the high and rising cost of living. Most people don't own stocks, so higher stock prices don't mean anything to their financial fortunes. And while big companies are reporting extraordinary bottom lines, small businesses are much more worried about how the events in Iran will play out. Given all this, I wouldn't take solace in the record stock market as an indicator of economic performance. Investors seem to think AI is safe from the risks that markets are ignoring, said Kyla Scanlon in the New York Times. Yet it is enormously dependent on stable global supply chains and a functioning energy market. One reason for investors' willingness to look past these vulnerabilities is that they have come to expect a form of salvation from Washington over the past 40 years. But now that rescue infrastructure is exhausted. The Federal Reserve has no way to cut interest rates without risking an inflationary wildfire. Soaring debt levels mean that any new fiscal support initiated by Congress, such as the loan program launched during COVID, faces real limits. Investors continue to buy the dip because they believe they don't have to properly price risk. That is a problem for all of us. A slippery grip on the financial cliff. Tens of millions of Americans are 3 months away from financial ruin, said John McGillion in The Hill. That's the finding from a recent national survey, which reported that $6,356 of additional debt is all it would take to push the average American household into bankruptcy. It's the cost of a secondhand car, a kitchen renovation, a modest health scare. That's the cliff edge. Nearly 544,000 Americans tipped over it last year, some 55,000 more than the number who declared bankruptcy the year before. American households have always lived under financial pressure. The difference today is that the pressure seems to be coming from everywhere at once. Tariffs have left a sizable dent in consumers' pockets. Healthcare is capable of dismantling a decade of careful saving with a single bad diagnosis. Inflation ate into what remained of the cushion that consumers had during COVID. Now, saving competes with too many immediate demands to accumulate meaningfully. Many people have given up waiting for someone to fix these systemic problems. It means rent falls behind. Medical appointments get postponed. It might be hyperbolic to suggest the American dream is dead, but a dream balanced on a $6,000 ledge in a stiff wind is not exactly thriving, and the wind is picking up. What was the Powell probe all for? President Trump's failed investigation into Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is emblematic of everything that's gone wrong with his second term, said Dan McLaughlin in National Review. The Justice Department dropped its inquiry into remarks Powell made about long-planned renovations to the central bank's headquarters. Score this as a win for retiring North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis, who resisted confirming Trump's nominee to replace Powell, Kevin Warsh, as long as the probe was ongoing. Tillis recognized immediately that the investigation was aimed at intimidating Powell into lowering interest rates as Trump wants. Tillis won his battle with the White House, but it never should have gotten this far. There was no popular constituency or coherent message for any of this. Trump was elected in good part to fight inflation, but he waged a scorched earth campaign to get the Fed to pursue an inflationary monetary policy. When that didn't work, there was no strategy for how to respond other than bank on winning a battle of wills. The result was another one of his schemes blowing up in his face, like the wily coyote deploying the Acme Fed chairman remover. That's what happens when leaders are willing to endorse lies and bogus legal theories. Obituaries. The traffic member who wrote "Feelin' All Right"? Dave Mason, 1946-2026. Dave Mason once called himself the Forrest Gump of rock. The English musicians strummed the acoustic guitar intro on Jimi Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower, blew an Indian Chennai on the Rolling Stones' Street Fighting Man, taught slide guitar licks to George Harrison, and recorded with Paul McCartney. As a guitarist, he toured with both Derek and the Dominoes and Fleetwood Mac. Mason was best known, though, as a co-founder of Traffic and the writer of 1967's Hole in My Shoe and 1968 Feelin' All Right, which was covered by more than two dozen artists, including Joe Cocker, the Jackson Five, and Huey Lewis. Bounced from the group, he went solo, scoring a 1977 hit with the soft rock We Just Disagree. That he wasn't a big star suited him just fine, he said in 2020. I never wanted to be. I just wanted to write great music, make some money, and have fun. Mason grew up in Worcester, England, where his parents ran a candy store. He sang in the school choir as a child, said Rolling Stone, but his love of music was sparked by the big bang of rock and roll. He began playing professionally at 16 and toured the UK and Germany before being recruited by keyboardist Steve Winwood to form Traffic in 1967. The band honed a sound marrying the Baroque British fantasies of early Pink Floyd with the melodicism of the Beatles. His tenure proved fraught, said the New York Times. Only 19, he felt overwhelmed by the spotlight and quit after one album. The other band members, who needed more songs for a follow-up, asked him to return, and he rejoined. But then Winwood fired him after the second album's release, a move Mason attributed to jealousy. To reinvent himself, he moved to Los Angeles, said the Telegraph of the UK, and put out an acclaimed solo album, Alone Together, in 1970. He toured with Delaney and Bonnie, formed a short-lived duo with Mama Cass Elliott, played on George Harrison's landmark album All Things Must Pass, and went platinum with his 1977 album Let It Flow. His career was often turbulent, marked by record company lawsuits and a battle with drug addiction, but he toured until well into his 70s when he was sidelined by poor health. I've been through 4 earthquakes, 3 marriages, 2 bankruptcies, 1 major hurricane, and I've survived the music business, he said in 1996. That's a pretty good record. The Diplomat Who Risked Everything for Refugees, Lionel Rosenblatt, 1943 to 2026. When Lionel Rosenblatt saw that Saigon was about to fall to the communists, he knew he had to save his friends. A Foreign Service officer who'd been stationed there to help prop up the U.S.-backed South Vietnamese government, he'd worked with dozens of South Vietnamese who would face torture or execution once the enemy reached the city. Without telling his State Department bosses, he and colleague Larry Johnstone flew to the city in April 1975 to devise an audacious, unauthorized plan to rescue those who had helped Americans. Over 5 frantic days, the two held clandestine meetings at a faux restaurant and a hotel terrace to make evacuation arrangements, bribing officials, and quickly manufacturing departure documents. Rosenblatt managed to get some 200 Vietnamese out and had found his calling. He would later become head of the nonprofit Refugees International. When the U.S. in 2021 failed to evacuate the Afghans who had helped Americans, he found it disgraceful, saying he'd tell Afghans, "You can't count on the United States." The son of a nuclear physicist, Rosenblatt grew up in Bellport, New York. After graduating from Harvard, he joined the Foreign Service and was quickly sent to Vietnam. There he became passionately loyal to the people he worked alongside, said the New York Times. After Vietnam, he devoted his diplomatic career to the displaced, especially ethnic minorities whose fates were largely regarded as collateral damage, said the Associated Press. As State Department refugee coordinator in Bangkok, Rosenblatt assisted Vietnamese boat people Cambodians escaping famine, and Hmong fighters who had supported the U.S. secret war in Laos. Knowing the Hmong faced discrimination, he obscured their ethnic status on official paperwork to make sure they made it to America. Rosenblatt left government and in 1990 took charge of Refugees International, said the Washington Post. That allowed him to shape the response to some of the biggest humanitarian crises of the late 20th century, including war in the Balkans, genocide in Rwanda, famine in Somalia, and fighting in Chechnya and Sudan. Always resourceful, he once forged a UN badge using a cigarette lighter and some plastic to get diplomat Richard Holbrooke into besieged Sarajevo. But most of all, he was a passionate advocate for settling refugees in the U.S. They are an inspiring example, Rosenblatt said in 2022. We need that kind of fresh blood and energy in this country. The lawyer who made women's rights more than a punchline, Sonia Pressman Fuentes, 1928 to 2026. Desperation turned Sonia Pressman Fuentes into a key figure in feminism, the first woman attorney at the Equal Rights Employment Opportunity Commission. She was tasked with enforcing the part of the 1964 Civil Rights Act that bars employment discrimination based on race or sex. Yet, when she brought up women's rights in her talks to employers and unions, the audiences of mostly men just laughed. That's why, when Betty Friedan visited the commission to research a book, Fuentes pulled her aside. I took her in my office with tears rolling down my cheeks, Fuentes recalled, and I said, what this country needs is an organization to fight for women like the NAACP fights for its constituents. Friedan soon started the National Organization for Women, and Fuentes joined as a founding member. She was born in Berlin, but her Jewish family had to flee the Nazis in 1933. They came to upstate New York. After graduating from Cornell University, she worked a series of frustrating secretarial jobs, said the New York Times, and then went to law school, a rarity for women in the 1950s. Her work at the EEOC opened her eyes to women's issues, and she talked about sex discrimination so often that her boss referred to her dismissively as a sex maniac. Still, she amassed accomplishments, including getting airlines to stop firing flight attendants once they married. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.